Yeah, I knocked someone on the head, then went through their bag, then stole their laptop, then stole my nachos. Yeah, then stole nachos on it.
And you're
going to
give it back.
Okay, so...
You're going to
be
really
rude this
advice. Let's get started. Few announcements. The lab, I heard from the TA yesterday that many of you, I guess most of you are not even here today, but those of you who came in yesterday hadn't even looked at it, let alone get started. So I sent off an email yesterday evening saying, please start on the lab. Don't wait until next week to get started. There are two parts. It'll take some time. It's an individual assignment. So the earlier you start, the better off you will be in terms of getting it actually done. Okay. So I will send out another email tomorrow, just to remind people, because most of you are not even here today. The other announcement, which is also on the course webpage, is that the first midterm is going to be 2 weeks from today. Okay? Two Thursdays from today, which I believe is October 11th. So we have a midterm early October, second midterm early November, final exam early mid-December. Okay, once a month there are exams, yes.
Is that an in-class exam or a night exam?
Okay, so I should mention, so everything is actually already on the page. It is going to be in this class, but not during the lecture hour. Okay, it's going to be 7 to 8:30 p.m., evening exam.
Here?
Yes, here. We will make sure the doors are open and everything.
That's right.
Don't worry about getting into the building. We'll let you in. Actually, the front door is never locked until 11. The middle core is locked, so you can just come in from the front door.
I think.
Yes.
What sections will be covering on the midterm?
So I'll mention that also. So everything until monitors, which I'm going to start today, will be on the test. We will do reviews of all the material and all of that. So there should be absolutely no confusion. Okay, as to what the exam. In fact, I will give out a sample midterm as well from a previous semester. So you can actually look at what the exams. Of course, none of those questions will be on the test. So.
Is there any class that day?
Is there? I am debating whether to have class that day or not. I will announce that shortly, because if it makes sense to come and review some material for the exam or some such thing, I may actually hold a class just to help.
We just have an optional review session?
I will actually, the previous day, Wednesday, is going to be a discussion. I'm going to do a full-blown review on that day. Unfortunately, the Tuesday is a virtual Monday, so there is no class on Tuesday, right before the midterm. So that week, basically, we'll have the first meeting will be on the discussion day. Wednesday, I will do a review. And if you need to do some more, I can do it the next day on Thursday. So, okay? Any questions on that? Alright, so let's continue the discussion from last time. So we were talking about locks, and I think towards the end of the class I probably lost more than two-thirds of the class. I'm going to do a review of some of that material. First, I wanted to clarify this issue that came up yesterday on the multi-level feedback queue, MLFQ scheduler. So as far as I am concerned, I want you all to understand how MLFQ works. Okay. I actually mentioned this when I taught the class and gave those examples. I think several of you are confused with the notation. Okay. What is the subscript? I don't actually care how you compute how MLFQ works. That was one suggested notation. You are free to use whatever notation you want. If you are given a problem which says here are three jobs, here are three queues, this is what happens, tell us when the jobs complete, what are their wait times, you can show your work and use whatever notation you are comfortable with. Okay, so I am not as worried about any notation. I want all of you to understand the algorithm. That's more important. Okay, so if you don't like the notation we use, that's okay. You can use whatever notation you want, but when you provide the solution, explain your notation. What is it that you are using? Okay, so we understand it. Okay, so that's one thing I wanted to clarify. Yes.
Much of the confusion was actually not necessarily doing it, but figuring out what you meant by specific, yeah, like alternating IO. Does that mean it IOs every cycle? Or is that
yes.
There was some confusion with the specific example was that program A had a
IO every other second. So
every second, and yep. The time quantum was 1 second.
Yes. So I think that if there is ever a question on this on the homework or the exam, it will be very clear. There won't be any point of confusion. We'll tell you whether the IO occurs as the last instruction of the quantum or whatever it is. It will not be ambiguous. Okay, so all that you don't have to worry about. In any case, you can always ask questions if you're not clear, even during an exam. But I don't think any of this doesn't mean there is going to be a question. I'm just saying if there is a question, all those issues will be clarified. Okay, so MLFQ scheduler, try to understand the algorithm. You feel free to tweak the notation to your liking, not a problem. Okay, so now we're coming back to locks, which we started talking about last time. So I think the concept of a lock is hopefully clear, but when I was discussing the hardware implementation of locks, I think some of you were not clear as to what I was talking about and how things were going to work and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to review that a little. Okay, so you first need to understand what the hardware is providing. If you don't understand that hardware feature, it's not going to be clear as to what the implementation is even doing. Okay, so first you need to understand what test and set instruction is. This really at some level has nothing to do with locks, although it's put in there to implement synchronization. Okay. So that's an assembly instruction. Okay, so you need to understand what it does first. Okay, so as I said last time, maybe I should ask somebody to explain. Okay, so if you do test and set and you specify some integer variable I, what is going to happen? What does this instruction do?
Yeah. At an atomic instruction, it tests that register for the presence of that value and then immediately sets it to the specified value I.
Okay. Yes, you have something.
It reads the value of I and returns the value of I and sets it to 1.
Okay. So, yes. So both of these are actually what you said is the compare instruction, but it's equivalent. Okay, so but doesn't matter. So let's say I is an integer. It's a memory. It's stored as a value in memory. We set it to some value. Let's say for now it's set to 0. What test and set is simply doing is it's actually going to access the current value of I and is going to return it. Okay, and set the value of I equals 1. So simply if this is one assembly instruction that does it. If you were to think of it as a function, what it is doing is it's basically saying j equals I equals to 1. This is effectively what it is doing. It's reading that value of I and then it's going to return that value at the end, and then it's going to just set that value to 1. Of course, now this is actually happening as one atomic assembly instruction that's going to fire in one cycle, one clock cycle, but that's effectively what it is doing. Okay, it reads the value of whatever operand you specify, returns it, and sets the value to 1. Okay? So that's the first thing you should understand as to what it is. And then you can ask, okay, now that we understand that. So the other concept you need to understand is enabling and disabling interrupts. Okay? So we know what interrupts are. Yeah, those are special conditions that raise a signal that causes a suspension of a process that's being executed, switch to the operating system. The operating system goes to a special function called an interrupt service routine, and it says what is this interrupt, and it tries to do something about it. Okay? So that's what interrupts are. So basically, you don't control when interrupts occur. Interrupts can arrive at any time. Okay, and that is going to cause the suspension of whatever is executing. Okay, and so when we introduce the notion of synchronization and critical section, if we don't want this something else to run, we just want this code to execute without getting interrupted, quote unquote interrupted. What one way to do this is you are going to disable the interrupts. In particular, when you do that, even the timer interrupts get disabled. The timer interrupt is disabled. The CPU scheduler cannot run. Because the CPU scheduler is invoked whenever that quantum timer expires and it's going to choose something else to execute. Okay? So if you disable interrupts, you are effectively disabling the CPU scheduler from running for a small period of time. So the critical section code is going to execute without being interrupted. So what that means is you don't have to worry about what happens if you switch to some other thread and it ran. You are preventing the OS from doing that. Okay? That's how this entire critical section is going to execute atomically. Okay? So I think I still have the lecture notes from last time somewhere. Lecture 7. Yeah, so where did we have this? Okay, so just to go back to what we were talking about, this is how you would actually implement locks. You will, in the acquire, you are going to disable the interrupt. You are going to check the value of a lock. So all of this you want to happen atomically. Some thread is called acquire. So you want to atomically check, is the lock available? If so, atomically give that lock to that thread, and if not, put the thread to sleep. In one, so you don't want anything to happen while this is going on. So you will disable interrupts, check the value of the lock. If lock is available, you set the lock to be busy and you just the thread has the lock. If not, you are going to add the thread to the wait queue and put it to sleep. Yes,
question. Disable the interrupt
so that no other control. Yes. The reason we are doing this is you want to make sure while you are running this piece of code, nothing else should actually run in the system. Sorry, what did you say? This is a hard, think of it as a hard, exactly. It's like a hardware lock. Effectively, you're saying, do not interrupt me while this code is running. Okay, so nothing else can run while this is running. That's a way to do it. Okay? So that's the concept you need to keep in mind there. And then, is that clear? Are there any questions on this? Yes,
your question. Why would you use one method over another?
Why would you use one method over another? So that's a good question. So they are equivalent. Okay? If you are a library designer, say go implement locking in your library, in concept of lock, you can do it this way or the other way. It doesn't really matter. They are roughly equivalent. I am just showing that you can use one of two hardware features to implement it. It doesn't matter which one you pick. This one, as you know, doesn't have any busy wait. The test and set will have either busy wait or some minimal busy wait. Okay, so those are the things to keep in mind. So there are some small pros and cons. There you can actually service interrupts and still get it right. Here some interrupts may get masked and they may get lost. So long as this code is very small, you probably will not have any lost interrupts. So there are some small pros and cons, but by and large they are equivalent. Okay, so it doesn't matter which one you pick. At some level you can implement locks either way. Okay, this is the one with test and set. Okay, so here what we are going to do is we are going to the property we want is if the lock is free, you acquire the lock and just continue executing whatever critical section you want to execute. And if the lock is in use, you want the thread to be blocked, meaning it cannot make progress. So that's what you are going to use with test and set. Okay, so you'll set the value of the lock to zero, which means it's free. And then any thread that calls acquire, you will do a while on test and set of value. Okay? So when you do this, it's going to return the current value of this variable, which initially happens to be zero, and it's going to write one. Okay? So this is going to return zero initially, and then it will set the value to one in an atomic instruction. So that condition will fail because zero is obviously not equal to one. So you will immediately exit the while loop. Okay, and that means you have acquired the lock and you can enter the critical section. Okay, second thread that comes in while the first thread still holds the lock is going to sit on and loop on this while loop because now the value of this variable is 1. So test and set will actually return 1 and write 1 back. Okay, so value of this lock is not changing, but because this condition is now true, it will just sit on that while loop and wait for the lock. Okay, so it's going to do busy wait. So this actually prevents that thread from entering the critical section because it's stuck here in the acquire method. It's not going into the critical section. Only when the first thread releases the lock and the value goes back to zero will you exit that while loop and enter. Okay, this ensure that only one thread can enter the critical section at any given time. Okay. So there's a version with minimal busy wait which I will skip. It should be the concept of test and set should be clear, really. Yes?
Yeah,
Okay. So we will switch back. So next time and during discussion section, this will be reviewed again for the larger class, because most of the people are not here today. So what we will do is today is to continue that discussion. Remember, I said there are three types of synchronization primitives we are going to study. Locks we are done. The other two are semaphores and monitors. We will do semaphores today and we'll start with monitors. Again, for those of you who did take 230, were semaphores covered or only locks? Just locks. Okay. Alright, so that's good. So there's something new here that you can look forward to. Yeah, so think of semaphores as a generalization of locks. Okay, so they will basically, you can use a semaphore exactly the way, as we will see, you can use it exactly the way you use a lock, but you can do other things with it. Okay. Now keep in mind, although I said they are a generalization of locks, in the last time I said that any of the synchronization primitives are equivalent from an expressive power perspective. Okay, just because a generalization doesn't mean there are some things you can do here that you cannot do there. It just means that the primitive itself allows you to do it in a more flexible way. You can still do whatever you can do with semaphores with locks as well. Okay, so that's one thing to keep in mind. So generalization, but not necessarily more powerful. Okay, and we'll see what the generalization is. Just as an aside, they were invented by Dijkstra in the early, not early, mid-60s. Anyone hear of Dijkstra? Okay, that's good. So, I think that it's important to, if you're taking a course on operating system, you need to know who Dijkstra is, but also and know about all the various things, abstractions he designed, that are actually in wide use today. Okay, so he came up with the concept of semaphores. He designed this algorithm called Banker's algorithm we are going to study. He designed this notion of deadlocks, deadlock detection. Actually, I have a page I pulled up just to remind myself all the things that he has done for computer science. So this is anyways Wikipedia page. He actually won the Turing Award in the early 70s. I hope you all know what the Turing Award is. Yes? Okay, thank you. It is it's equivalent. We don't have a Nobel Prize in computing, so this is the highest award you get in computer science. Okay, but just to give you a sense of all the stuff that he did, if you've taken a networking class, you may have heard of shortest path routing. Okay, he designed or came up with SPF, shortest path route. So he's also often called Dijkstra shortest path because he came up with that notion, came up with the notion of semaphore. He designed this early operating system called the operating system. Okay, so that, so that is where he came up with this notion of a semaphores. Then there's Banker's algorithm. A lot of the abstractions in synchronization he had actually designed back in the 60s. Okay, so they still live on today. Is also very famous. I mean, it's famous for lots of things, but back in those days, he actually wrote this influential papers called Go-To's Considered Harmful. I don't know if anybody heard of this paper, but back in those days, this is before anybody even came up with the notion of an if and else or a for loop or a while loop. So in those days, you basically used Go-To's to branch in your code. Okay, so if you wanted to, basically you could check a condition and say if that condition is false, you'll say go to this line number. Okay, and so everybody used to write, so you could write the for loop as a go to. You can decrement a counter, check a value, and if not, you go and you loop and things like this. So before all these constructs were actually designed and put in languages, people used to write code with go to's. And this resulted in what he called spaghetti code, that you had all these branches going from everywhere, so you jump from here to there to here, and then you want to debug the code and you have no idea what's going on, how the code is actually designed and what it does and so on. So he basically said that you should program without go-tos, because they are, so that he wrote this paper thing called Go-To's Considered Harmful, very influential paper. And then as a result of that debate, programming languages that were designed around that time got this notion of a if and an else or a for loop or a while loop or case statement, all the stuff that you see today. Okay, so you can basically write a program without any of this, and it's easy to understand what an if else does. Okay, but if you write the same code using go tos, it's really hard to understand. So lots of useful contributions. There are a lot more, but I just thought the stuff that we will actually encounter in the next 2-3 classes are all Dijkstra's inventions. Okay, so anyway, so that was just a digression on, but you can go read up more on him. There's lots of stuff you can find on the web. Okay, so coming back to semaphores, let me define, I said they are a generalization of a lock, but let me first define what they are. Okay, and then we will see why they actually generalize this notion of a lock. Okay, a semaphore is simply put an integer variable. Okay, so it's an integer variable that can be updated by two atomic instructions. Okay, so I think of it as an integer, but you can't just change its value any way you want. The only way you change it is using two atomic instructions that are going to be called wait and signal. Okay, we'll see what they are in just a moment. Okay, so that's what it is. Now, what does it do for us? So it depends on how you want to use it. There are two kinds of semaphore. The simplest one is called a binary semaphore, also called a mutex. Okay. So in a binary semaphore, this integer variable, as the name suggests, can only take two values, 0 or 1. Okay? And you can only flip the value from 0 to 1 or vice versa using two special atomic instructions that we'll look at in just a moment. Okay? So here, and what it does is exactly what a lock does. It guarantees mutually exclusive access to a resource. Okay? We'll see some code and see how it works. Okay? That's a binary semaphore. Can generalize that notion and have what's called a counting semaphore. Okay, and a counting semaphore, and they are used for slightly different purposes. This one is essentially a lock, as we'll see. There's practically no difference from a lock. This one you can actually generalize it to protect, instead of one resource, n resources. Instead of one critical section, you can have n critical section, not n critical section, but n resources that are being guarded. You can also use it to do useful scheduling, as we will see. Okay. And the only difference here is this one can take value from 0 to 1. A counting semaphore can take any value from 0 to n. Okay. You initialize it to some value n, and then it can range from 0 to n. It can take any of those values. Okay. If n is set to 1, a counting semaphore is basically the same as a binary semaphore. Okay. Very abstract definition, but let's understand what it does for us. Okay. So here is basically a use of a semaphore. The two special instructions that I actually said you use on a semaphore are called wait and signal. Okay? Think of it as a wait is the operation you will use to decrement your integer variable, and signal is the operation you are going to use to increment. There are only two things you can do. You can either decrement the semaphore or increment it. Okay? And you are going to do them atomically using an operation called wait on that semaphore or signal on the semaphore. Okay, wait will decrement, signal will increment. Okay, first it should be clear what wait and signal are doing. Now, in addition to what I just said, there are some wait and signal also have some special properties. Okay, so what? So here is the definition of wait and signal. So essentially, wait will decrement the semaphore, and it will also do the following. It will check what the decremented value is. And so long as the value is not negative, okay, it's not negative, it will let the thread continue. Okay, so if you initialize the semaphore to 1 and you call wait, it will decrement it to 0. 0 is not negative number, so it's basically going to continue. Next time a thread calls wait, okay, you will again decrement it, and the value has actually gone minus 1 at this point, and that will cause it to block. Because as I said, the value should really only range from 0 to n. Okay? So as soon as it sees that if you decrementing it causes the value to go negative, it will block at that point. Okay? So now you should see the analogy to locks. Okay? In locks, we set the value to free. The first thread that went in decremented it and made the lock unavailable, and subsequent threads blocked. Here, you are getting the same property just by checking the value of an integer. Okay? So, So if the process executes wait and the semaphore is free, which means it's non-zero, it's going to continue execution. And if not, it is going to block and you will put the thread or the process on the wait queue, exactly what a lock does. Okay, so I'll show you an implementation of binary semaphores and how you use it to solve too much milk, and then we will look at how you actually implement the semaphore itself. Okay, so remember, this is the lock implementation. You do an acquire, lock acquire, say if there is no milk, go buy milk, you do lock release. Okay, and this is the equivalent code using semaphores. Instead of acquire, you are going to do a wait, and then you have the same code. If there is no milk, you buy milk and you will do a signal. So signal is essentially doing the same as release. Wait is essentially doing the same functions here as acquire. Okay, this is how you would use it as a lock. Okay, so wherever you acquire, you blindly replace it with, instead of lock.acquire, you blindly replace it as semaphore.wait. And wherever you lock.release, you do this. You initialize the semaphore to 1 in this case. And that's like here you initialize the lock to be free. Okay, if you have those properties, the two are equivalent. Okay. Now let's look at what is actually happening in wait and signal. Okay, this is the implementation of a semaphore. No, I'm not showing disabling interrupts and all of those still have to happen, just the concept. Okay, so they think of it as wait and signal have to execute atomically, so you can disable and enable interrupts at the beginning and the end. Okay, so you can just do that. I didn't show that part. This is just the code. Okay, so this is the value that you are going to set it to in the constructor. Okay, in a binary semaphore, you'll set the value to 1. In a counting semaphore, you will set the value to n. You can choose what that n is. Okay, and this is the code. Okay, I said wait will decrement the value. That's what it does. Value is value minus 1, and it's checking is the value negative. If the value is strictly less than 0, you're just going to block. Okay, and so the first time you go in, value is 1, you decrement it, value becomes 0. 0 is not less than 0, so you will just continue, you won't block. Next time thread comes in, value goes negative. Okay, so then you are going to end up on that wait queue for the semaphore. Yes, question.
So if it gets locked like that and put on the queue, does it end up going to sleep?
Or yes, it's exactly the same as what we did in the lock. Question is, does it go to sleep if it's blocked? Essentially, we basically put it to the wait queue. I said P block, you can think of it as thread sleep. It's the same thing. Okay, you put it on the wait queue and put it to sleep. And signal does the opposite. Okay, you will increment the value, and then if the value is actually turned positive, you are going to say, is there something on the queue? If there is something on the queue, wake it up. If somebody was waiting, let it go ahead. Yes.
Why is value less than 0 and not value less than 1?
Why is value not less than 1? So you can just work it. Just, you have another question?
Oh no, I was going to say that this is an abstraction that allows you to have multiple ends. Like you can set and have 5 threads inside the same protected area.
Right. But let's first just ask, why is it not less than 1? So let's say you're using it as a binary semaphore. So you will say initialize it to 1. Okay. So now let the first thread call wait. See what happened. Okay. Value has gone from 1 to 0. Okay. Because you decremented. The first statement is decrement the value. Okay. But this is the first thread, so you want to let it in. If you want to let it in, then you should basically check that it's become negative, right? If it's less than 1, you will block the first thread itself. Okay? Is that clear? Same with counting semaphore. If you set it to n, the first n threads will actually acquire the, not acquire, but do a wait on the semaphore and not be blocked. Only the n plus first thread will get blocked. And that basically means you can allow it to decrement all the way to 0, and when it goes negative, you start blocking. Okay? Okay, so here are some examples that essentially allow you to work through the same code. Two threads or two processes, doesn't matter. We are going to say that here you initialize it to 2. So just working through what happens, what the value is and what does it do to each of those threads. So you do wait, signal, and that does wait and signal. And we assume that this is the interlink. This is how these instructions are going to get scheduled. Okay, so those four and those six instructions get scheduled in this order. Okay, so we have to see what happens to the value of the semaphore, what happens to the queue, the wait queue of the semaphore, and are they executing or are they going to be blocked? Okay, for this interleaving. Yes. If the value is still negative, that means there are some threads blocked, so that is why you will unblock them. Once the value is positive, that means nobody is blocked, because by definition, only when the value went negative did you start blocking them. If you have positive value, all the threads are executing. So you are doing this in reverse here. You could have just said if Q is not empty, it doesn't matter really. Okay, basically this is just saying if Q is not empty. If Q is not empty, wake someone up. Okay. Okay. So wait and signal for these two processes. Okay, so first process calls wait. Okay, what happens to the value of the semaphore? Decrement. Wait means decrement. Okay, so value becomes 1. Q is going to be empty. Non-zero values mean no blocking. Okay. P1 will continue to execute, not block. Okay, P2 hasn't done anything, it's just executing. Okay. You call the second wait. Okay. Value has gone to 0. Okay. Should you block P2 or not? Okay. So long as not negative, don't block. Okay, because you say 2 means 2 threads or processes can call wait and still okay. Okay, so Q will stay empty, P2 will also execute. Continue execution, not block. Okay. This point P1 is going to be calling its third wait. Okay. Now the value goes negative, -1. Okay, because 2, 1, 0, now it's -1. You have 3 decrements in a row, so you have to block P1. This value is negative, so Q will contain P1. P1 will be blocked. P2 is still executing. Okay. P2 calls signal. Signal increments. Okay. So value goes from -1 back to 0. Okay, and that point you check the queue. Queue has P1 and you basically get P1, let P1 execute. And P2 is basically just exiting the critical section. So it's still going to execute. Okay. And these two signals will continue to increment the value. Okay. From -1 back to 0 to 1 back to 2. Okay. I thought I had the solution there, but I don't. I can put it up if you need to. Is that clear? What happened? Maybe I should write that down. Your question is. Sorry, can you repeat your question? When does the queue clear P1? Let me write that down again. So your value is the queue. Okay. After the first wait. Value goes 0, Q is empty. The second wait here, value is going to be decremented, it becomes 0. You still leave the both of them continue to execute. Third wait is going to make it -1, so P1 is going to be blocked, so it goes on the queue. Okay? Then P2 goes and does a signal. Okay? At this point, you increment, so it goes back to 0, and you will unblock P1. Okay, so if you look at the code for signal, that's what is happening. You increment and it says if the queue is not empty, take the first process and unblock it. Okay, that's exactly what you did. You incremented it, you unblocked, there's only one thread on that queue, so you unblocked P1. Okay, and then the next two signals will keep incrementing, but the queue here remains empty, there's nothing to do. Any questions on this? Okay, so keep in mind that this is just abstract interleaving of wait and signal. We are not solving any useful synchronization problem here. So just to illustrate what happens to the value of the semaphore and what is happening in the queue, just to show you how this class works. Okay, we didn't do anything useful with this interleaving. We will solve some useful synchronization problems with semaphores shortly. Okay, I already showed you how to do too much milk. But that we already knew how to solve using locks. So we haven't learned anything new here yet. Okay. There's another example, but I'm going to skip that, okay, because it's just a similar thing and we don't want to belabor the point. Okay, but instead I'm going to show you what the generalization is and how can you do something useful with that generalization. Okay. This is where we are going to use the semaphore as a counting semaphore, not a binary semaphore. And we'll also no longer initialize it to a value that is either 1 to n, but we are going to initialize it to a different value, which is 0. And we'll see what happens. Okay. So let me first explain what we are even trying to do. Okay. Suppose you want to coordinate two threads. Okay, let's call them threads A and B. Okay, and you want to order what happens in these two threads. Let's say you want to execute, you want to ensure that some code in A always executes before some code in B. Okay, for whatever reason. How do you go about doing that? Okay, so I'm just going to write some trivial example. I'm going to say here is thread A. Wants to call okay. Suppose you are trying to solve some synchronization problem where you want always foo, function foo, to execute strictly before function bar. Okay. If you just let these threads execute, you are dependent on the scheduler, whatever, you are at the mercy of the scheduler. If A runs before B, foo will execute before B. If B runs before A, bar will execute before foo. You can't control it. You are just dependent on the schedule. But now you want to control it. Let's say you want thread A to have done something before thread does something else in your synchronization problem. Okay? How do you do that? So if this, you can think of now producers and consumer. You want the producer to produce something before the consumer consumes it. That's an ordering. There's nothing to consume. So having this run doesn't make any sense. You can actually express these scheduling orders using semaphores. Okay, you can control the order in which code in two different threads executes, and you can strictly order them. And I'll show you how to do it. Okay? So very simple. All you will do is you will use a semaphore and you will initialize it to 0, not to 1 anymore or not to n, but you are simply going to initialize it to 0. Okay? And here is what you are going to do with it. Well, let me just show you first and then I can. Okay, so we'll say semaphore equal to 0. We simply do sem.wait. And here we're going to do so first understand that so far the lock, acquire, release and wait signal were within the same critical section. Now you have split the wait and the signal across two different threads in this case. But here is what we have done. We said we want foo to execute before bar. Okay. So what does that mean? It means that thread B should block if foo has not executed. Right? And the way we are going to do it is we are going to put a semaphore.wait before this function, and we are going to write this foo, and we are going to put a semaphore.signal. If you do this, now no matter how the scheduler schedules this thread, you will be guaranteed that this piece of code executes before this piece of code. Okay? And you can just try all the ordering and you will see. There are only two ways these two threads can execute. Either this can execute before A can execute before B, or B can execute before A. Okay? For let's take the case where B starts, scheduler starts executing B first. Okay? So you are going to call semaphore wait. Okay, what happens? Okay? Value is set to 0. Wait will decrement. Right?
Oh wait, I thought it started at 0.
Yes, it does start at 0. But whenever you call
-1,
sorry?
Decrements -1.
Yes, you start with 0, wait will decrement it, so now it became -1. Okay, what does that mean? -1 means block. Okay, so as soon as you, if scheduler happens to choose B to execute, as soon as you call wait, B will block. It hasn't even gotten to bar, it's just going to block here. Okay, so B is gone to sleep. Okay, subsequently scheduler will choose A, A is going to go into foo. This is just an unprotected function. We'll execute that code and you are going to call signal. Okay? When you call signal, you are going to increment that semaphore. So it went back from minus 1 to 0. The queue is not empty. B is sleeping. So you will wake up B. Okay? And then B will subsequently execute and the bar will execute. So what happened was, you will basically run this, you will block, you will run foo, you will do signal, signal will cause B to wake up and then you execute bar. So you ensure that even though B ran first, foo has executed before bar. Okay? The other way around also is going to work for. Okay, let's say A ran first, so anyway foo is executed. Okay, because you will just start executing, you will do signal. Okay, what does signal do? It will increment semaphore. Okay, so see here, if this runs first, semaphore will go to 1. Okay, and A is going to continue doing something else. Subsequently, B will run. Okay, it's going to do a wait. But what happens to the semaphore? It goes back to 0. That's not negative, so this is not going to block it. We'll just let it continue and bar will execute. Okay, so this doesn't matter what the scheduler is doing. We have managed to order how the code executes for us. In particular, we manage to have foo always execute before bar regardless of what the scheduler has done for us, is doing. Okay, can I explain anything here before I move on? Is this clear? Yes, yes, my question.
I just have a general question about like the test instruction. Is that something that you have to use, is that something usually in kernel mode, or is that something that user mode can do as just part of user mode? Or is that a protected instruction?
So question is about test and set. Is that a protected instruction? Do you use it in user mode or kernel mode? Typically, if semaphores are actually, or locks are, have kernel mode support, they would be executed in the kernel. It is not necessary that test and set is a privileged instruction. You can use it for other purposes, not just implementing locks and semaphores. But when you are implementing locks and semaphores and you have kernel level threads, you do it there. It's because you can also user level thread, test and set is not protected. Okay, but that should not matter from how semaphores behave, whether it's user mode, kernel mode. Semaphores are going to behave the same as far as we are concerned. Okay, user level or kernel level thread shouldn't matter. Okay, but what should be clear now is you have a way by which you can get code, order code in different threads by using semaphores. Okay. And so you can basically use counting semaphores and generalize that. You can actually force different ordering in a similar way. Okay? So let's now look at producers and consumers. We are going to actually use this simple idea to order producers and consumers. Okay, so remember I mentioned this problem some time ago. I think it was two or three classes ago. So you have this abstract notion of a producer. Okay. More than one, you can have more than one producer. Okay. Here are your consumers. Okay, there's a shared buffer. So producers are producing some data. What that data is, we don't care. Let's assume they just produce some tokens or data. So they produce data and they stick it into this buffer. Consumers, we actually consume data from the buffer. Okay. This is simply a way of solving synchronization problem. It's an abstract problem, but if you want to do data exchange, you want the producer to do some work and pass on some data to the consumer, this is how you are going to do it. Okay? This is the shared buffer. Okay? In the general version of the problem, you can have n consumers, each of which is producing data and sticking it there, and you have m consumers, each of which is a thread which is consuming from this. Okay? And all you want are the following correctness and liveness properties. Okay, you want to ensure that the producer doesn't overflow the buffer. Okay, if the buffer can be of limited size, let's say k, so there are k slots in the buffer. Okay? If the buffer is full, which means there are k items that are not yet consumed, you cannot produce anymore. Okay? Because if you produce somewhere, there's no place to put it. So then the producers have to block. And vice versa, if the buffers are all, the slots are all empty, there is nothing to consume. So if a consumer thread gets scheduled, it should block. Okay? Clear or not clear? Yes. Yes, it's clear. Okay. So what does this mean? It simply means you have to order a produce function has to always run before a consume function. Because you want a producer to produce something that the consumer can consume. Okay? Because and now we know how to do that. Okay, we just learned how to do that. So replace this with produce. Replace this with consume. Yes?
So can you clarify the consumer relationship a little for me?
Sure.
So the sem.wait function is what's telling B not to execute, right?
Yes. In this case, so the sem.wait is.
Wait reduces the sem value, and then it's increased by sem signals, right?
Yes.
What if you had like a whole bunch of consumers, and you call wait with each of them? Then
they will
all hold the wait, but the sem value is reduced so low that the sem signal won't increase it back up to a value that will make the other one execute.
Yes, that's true. So let me show you the code. Okay, so maybe it's easier if you just go back to the code. So this part you understand, right? So here what happens is you always increment the value. Just think of this as if Q is not empty, wake up a thread.
Okay.
So when you do a signal, you are going to increment the value and you are going to say, is that Q, semaphore Q not empty? There are several of those consumers that are sleeping there, so you will wake one up.
Okay, so it takes one arbitrarily?
That is up to the implementation. You can do FIFO, you can say last in, first, or how it picks is not important. You can just assume first come, first serve. The first thread to sleep would is the first thread to be woken up.
So, I mean, the assumption that the value and the sem dot value will high enough to account for a whole bunch of consumers, or
yes. So the trick is how you initialize this, okay, as we will see in the producers and consumers. So if so long as you initialize it the right way, you will be okay. Okay. So, but all you have to remember is whenever you do signal, you are going to increment it. If there is some thread on the queue, you are also going to wake it up. That's all you have to do. Okay. And wait is going to do the reverse. It's going to decrement, and if the value goes negative or is already negative, you are going to be blocked and put on this queue. Okay, that's what the implementation does. So if you blindly just follow the implementation, you will see how this works. Okay. So as far as producers and consumers go, we'll actually use not one but three semaphores. Okay, because there's one ordering which I said, it's just producers have to produce before consumers. Okay. This is another ordering we want to ensure. If the queue is, or this buffer is full, you want the consumer, at least one consumer function to run and make one of these slots non-empty before another producer can run as well. Is that clear what I said? First we want the producer to produce something, so we want to order the producer to come before the consumer. But also if all these slots are taken, you don't want additional producer threads to run, because there is no place to put the data items they are producing. You want to block all of them. And in particular, you want at least one consumer to run, consume something, free up a slot so that the next producer can run. So here you have a reverse ordering saying I want one consumer function to run before the next producer can run whenever the buffer is full. Okay? Two types of ordering. Producer should produce something before consumer can consume, and if the buffer is full, the consumer should consume something before a producer can run. Okay, so both way you have to order it both ways. Okay, so that's why you have two semaphores here. One is called full, empty, the other one is called full, and there is a mutex which is basically just a lock. Okay, this is a binary semaphore. This is just going to protect our critical section. We are just using it as a lock. These two are the ones that are allowing us to order. The producer runs before the consumer can consume, or the consumer should consume something from a full buffer before the next producer can. And that's all that is there in there. Okay, that looks more complicated than it is, but the code is actually very simple if you just understand this ordering relationships. Okay, so first what you are going to do, so empty is a semaphore that's initialized to N. Full is a semaphore that's initialized to zero. So you will see that the producer produces and then it decrements wait. I mean, not decrements wait, rather decrements empty. Okay? Because you initialize this to N, N is also incidentally the size of the array. That's our shared array, size of N. Okay? So what that means is up to N producers can run before anyone is blocked, because initially the array is empty. So you can let all N run all at once and fill the buffer up, and you are not going to block any producer. Okay? So if initially all n producer threads run and they fill up the buffer, okay, then the n plus 1 producer runs, empty is going to go negative. At that point, that producer is going to be blocked, saying your buffer is full, please wait. Okay, let some consumer run and consume something before you can consume it. Okay, is that clear? Okay. Look at what is happening to the consumer. The first instruction here is you are going to do a wait on full. Full has been initialized to 0. Okay. So if by any chance your scheduler is going to start running a consumer thread, okay, it will call wait on full. Okay, wait will go from 0 to negative and the consumer will block. Okay. And that's the right thing to do because the buffer is empty. There is nothing to consume. The scheduler just happened to run as consumer before a producer ran. Okay. So now ask the question, what happens if the producer ran and then the consumer ran? So you will see that the last statement here is you are doing a signal. That's essentially that statement. So if the producer actually runs first, it will increment full. Okay. Full will go from 0 to 1. Okay. That means if the consumer runs next, it will just go without blocking because there is a data item in the buffer. That's exactly what happened here when A was scheduled before B. That is the right ordering. The producer ran before the consumer. It's already produced something. It did a signal and you do. Okay? Is that clear? So we are using two semaphores, a semaphore called empty and a semaphore called full, and this is allowing us to order. Then the product, and now it does no longer matter what the scheduler does. We control the ordering in which these threads run to ensure correctness properties for the problem we are trying to address, the producer consumer problem. Okay, and there's also mutex here. That's just a lock. Okay, this is a shared data structure. Okay, you don't want to be taking something and some other thread to be putting something in there. So we basically just protect it with a lock. Okay, we think of it as lock.acquire. Okay, any shared data structure, if you are threaded code, always protect it with a lock, regardless of whether access. So you just protect this by the lock. So this is a mutex, it's simply a lock. Okay. So that's the solution to your producers and consumers. And this will generalize to arbitrary numbers of producers and consumers. Okay, you are asking the question how it works. Is that clear now or
is it?
Okay. Okay, so this is why this is somewhat of a generalization, because you couldn't use locks to order. Okay, locks will simply make something block. Okay, but here we can actually order how code runs, okay, by using semaphores in the appropriate way. You can also control how many threads get to run before somebody blocks by initializing it appropriately. So lots of interesting things can be done. Okay, so there is something here which I'm going to ignore. So that's basically semaphores. Okay, so just to recap, it's an integer variable that is can be manipulated by two special methods, wait and signal. Wait decrements, signal increments. Whenever the value goes non-zero, when you decrement it, you block. Okay, and vice versa, when you signal if there is anyone waiting in the queue, you unblock one of those threads. Okay, that's the way semaphores work. If you use it as a simple binary semaphore and initialize it to 1, you get the same property as a lock. But as I said, you can do several more interesting things. You can initialize it to 0 and use signal and wait to order code execution sequences. Okay, any questions on this before I move on to monitors? Now, this all sounds interesting. But as you can imagine, writing this code is not the easiest of tasks. Okay, this looks a little more, you have to think about, oh, how many semaphores do I need, what do? How do I initialize it? Yeah, if you can understand all that, you can implement it. So we will now look at another abstraction called monitors that does the same thing but will simplify it. Okay, we can write code in a much more easy way and it will still give us all these properties. Okay, so in other words, semaphores are a low-level abstraction. They do give you a lot of power, but you need to really understand how to solve a problem using semaphores and do all these things. Okay, so we'll ask the question. I already said what is wrong with the force. So they are good abstraction, but there are several issues, as I said. Okay, they are shared global variables. We don't care about that aspect right now. There is no direct connection between how semaphores were used and what the shared data structure is. It is just these are two independent variables. We are just use not variable data structure. We are using them in different ways. Okay, this is overloaded. Okay, the abstraction is overloaded. You can use it as a lock, and you can use it to express scheduling constraints. So sometimes it's a lock, and sometimes it's ordering threads. Okay, if you had two different abstractions that did these two things independently, life would be much simpler. Could use one to order code, the other one to do locking. Okay, so here we are overloaded one abstraction, and we can use it two different ways. Okay, so we would like cleaner abstractions. From a design standpoint, from a programmer standpoint, it's much easier. Because if I just gave you code with a semaphore, you really have to look. Is it being used as a lock, or is it being used to do scheduling constraint? You have to go back, see what was it initialized, what order things run, what is it doing. Okay? That's not a clean abstraction. When you overload it, it's trying to do two very different things with one mechanism. Okay? Last but not least, okay, there is no guarantee of proper usage. Okay? You can write code where your program will not run the way you intended it to run. If you initialize it to the wrong way, if you actually flip this initialization, this code will actually just stop working. Okay? So there is no guarantee, unless you use semaphores the right way, that your code is actually going to behave. So you want simpler abstractions that you know just by looking at it, it works. Okay? This is the same as when I produced or gave solution 3 for too much milk. I said it works, but by looking at it, it's not clear. You have to really reason what's going on, and then you understand. Okay? Same is true here. You have to understand what is it doing. Okay, I'm sure that even though I explained this, not some of you may not have completely got all the nuances of how this works. You want to simplify. Okay, so what abstractions can we use for it? Okay, so we are going to use now a higher level abstraction that will give us all the expressive power of semaphores, but in a much more cleaner, elegant, simpler way. Okay, and that is called monitors. Okay, the higher level primitive. Okay, so it is going to simplify, but as I said, they are all equivalent from an expressive power perspective. Okay, and you will see why this is a cleaner abstraction. Okay, so think of a monitor. So all of you know Java, right? Yes? Java? Okay. Better know Java, otherwise we are in trouble. So monitor is basically, think of it as a class, okay, that has some method and that has some data. Okay, but it's a special class. Then we'll see what that special class is. Okay, so in particular, it's a class that ties the data operations with synchronization that you want to do on the data and the code. Okay, so any class that you have ever written, okay, Java class that I've written, can be turned into a monitor by adding one keyword, specifically the synchronized keyword. I don't know if any of you used it when you did 230. I guess 230 is in C++ now, so maybe not. Okay, so here is a formal definition, and I'll show you how to actually implement, how do you use monitors in Java. Okay, what is a monitor? Essentially, monitor is a class that has two mechanisms. It has a lock, okay, and it has zero or more what are called condition variables. Okay, and we'll define what condition variables are. But here, basically, as you can see, there are two mechanisms. Okay, in semaphores, you overloaded this mechanism by saying sometimes it works as a lock and sometimes you use it to do scheduling. Here, we are going to separate the two very cleanly. We'll say there is a lock, and lock is only used to do mutual exclusion. And there's something else called a condition variable that is only used to specify scheduling constraints. Okay? So we just basically separated the two, so you know if you are using the lock, what is it doing? If you are using a condition variable, what is it doing? Okay? So the monitor is going to use the lock to ensure that only one thread can execute a method of that class any time, of that monitor. Okay? So lock is just used to ensure that only one thread is executing any method of that class. Okay. It also provides mutual exclusion for any shared data. Okay. One thread executes a function, that means any data that is in that class, only that thread can access. Okay. And condition variables, basically, the definition is it allows a thread to go to sleep inside a critical section and release the lock that they hold. I'll explain what that means. Okay, but this is what it does. So if you are a thread that holds a lock and you call a condition variable, you give up your lock and you go to put yourself to sleep. Okay, so you can schedule yourself by putting yourself to sleep. Okay. Let me explain before I come back to the operation how it works. Okay, so if you know, since you know Java, this is basically an implementation of a semaphore. Okay. So you can turn any Java class into a monitor. This is how you do it. You take all the data and make it private. Okay. And you take every method of that class and you use the word keyword synchronized. Add the word synchronized in front of that method. And once you do this, your method has turned into a monitor. Okay. What that gives you, I'll explain. Okay. Very simple. Okay. So this is basically our producers and consumers. Okay. Explained, using a Java class, pseudocode Java. Okay. So what have we done? So we basically, a producer has to add a data item, consumer has to remove a data item. Okay. So we added the word synchronized here. Okay. What that immediately does is, if you have Java threads, okay, it will ensure that there is only one thread that can be in any synchronized method of this class at any given time. Okay. If any thread is in the add method, any other thread that calls add or remove will be immediately blocked. Okay. So think of it as a global lock on this entire class. So basically the word synchronized does is internally it's implemented in the JVM as a global lock on the class. So before you call any method of that class, internally the JVM is making that thread grab a lock. Okay, once you have a lock, then no other thread can call any method of that class until that thread executes, exits. Rather. Yes, question.
The lock on the class or the object?
There's a lock, on the object, not on the class. By class, I meant an object, an instance of the class, which is an object. Okay, is that clear? So, if you add the word synchronize, that by definition is assuming that if you have this is a queue, so you can have only one thread be in either add or remove. Okay? So you can just put an item, you can remove an item, and that's a shared data search. So we'll talk about what condition variables do next. Okay. So now let's assume that the queue is empty. Okay, that's a shared buffer here, right? So let's assume that's empty. The consumer runs first. Okay, so what is this code going to do? The consumer will call remove. What will it do? It synchronize. So let's assume it gets the lock. It goes in, says, is the queue not empty? Queue is actually empty. So it's not going to go into the if statement. It's going to just exit, remove. Okay, no harm done. Basically, it says the queue empty, queue was not empty, so your consumer has just exited. Okay. What would have been the right thing to do? If you want to call remove and you want to actually get a data item from the queue, what should you have done if the queue was empty? You should have blocked. If the consumer runs first and the buffer is empty, what should the consumer do? It should block and wait for a producer to actually add something into your data, into the queue. Okay. So here what we would like is, if the queue is empty, go to sleep. Okay. Somebody will wake you up when a data item is added to the data structure. But if the queue is not empty, what it's doing is right, because it'll say go and take a data item and return it. Okay, so you want an abstraction which says, hey, if the task I'm trying to do cannot be done at this point in time, go to sleep, block. Okay, and then when somebody else will wake you up at the right time. Okay, so how do you do that? That is basically what condition variables will allow us to do. Okay, that's what it's saying. How do we change remove to wait? Basically, you want to go into sleep. Want to go to sleep. But here is the important part. Okay, if you simply wrote sleep here, you are going to basically have a deadlock. Okay. Why is that? Yes.
It's still in the object.
Still in the object. If you are in a synchronized method, you hold a global lock on that object. And if you go to sleep with a global lock, nothing else can run by definition. Okay? There is nobody, there is no help on the way because nobody can do add. Because you hold the lock, you went out to sleep, some other thread comes and tries to add, it's going to block because you are still holding the lock. Okay? So you better release the lock before you go to sleep so somebody else can do useful work on this object. Yes? So that's essentially what condition variables do for you. Okay, so it atomically, if you call a condition variable, it atomically releases the lock. Okay, you don't do any locks, you don't see any lock. So it will release the lock for you and it will put that thread to sleep. Okay, that's essentially what condition variables. So the condition variables enable a thread to sleep inside a critical section, and the way it is done is any lock that is held by that thread is atomically released when the thread is put to sleep. The implementation of monitors does this for you. You don't do anything. You just call the condition variable method and it will do it. Okay, so here is how they work. So condition variables have the same kind of abstraction as a semaphore. Okay, you can call a wait on a condition variable. You can call a signal. Okay, you can also call something called broadcast or a wait all, not wait, notify all, and I'll tell you what that does in a minute. Okay, the only rule is before you call wait, You better be holding the lock because it makes you give up the lock and it makes you go to sleep. Okay? So you can only do this inside a synchronized method. Otherwise your code is going to have some trouble. Okay, so here is basically what it does. Okay, so add has nothing has changed. It's still synchronized. Okay? There is now, by default, when you have a monitor class, there's a default condition variable that Java will declare for you. You can declare additional ones, but there's one. So think of it as this dot wait. Okay, so you're basically just calling the default condition variable. So all you're doing is, while the queue is empty, you just call wait, which makes it give up the lock that it grabbed when it entered and go to sleep. Okay, and then when you exit this while loop, you just remove and return the data item. Okay. So what does this do? And here you have the equivalent of signal. So signal here is actually in Java, they are called notify. Okay, so the equivalent of signal for semaphore. It's the same thing, it just called something else. Okay, so here you put an item on the queue and you call a signal, which is a notify method. Yes?
When did you use notify all?
Okay, so we'll talk about notify all in just one moment. Let's first understand what notify and signal are doing. Notify and wait are doing. Okay, we'll come back to notify all. Okay, so what does it do for us? Okay, so basically look at the definition of notify is, if some thread is sleeping, okay, you wake it up. If there are no threads sleeping, it doesn't do anything because there's nobody to wake up. Okay, wait basically says give up your lock and go to sleep. Okay, so first question I'll ask, if we understand what notify and wait do, is why is there a while here? Why is this not an if? And why, in particular, what would happen if you put an if there? Okay, yes.
If you put an if there, then as soon as the thread wakes up, it's not going to check again to see what the status of the queue is. It's just going to assume that it's good now and we're carrying on. There's a possibility that something wakes the thread up, but for whatever reason, the queue is still empty. So you want to have a while the queue is empty, so if the thread wakes up and the queue is still empty for some reason, it checks again and then goes back to sleep.
Right. So this code, as is just being mentioned, is just written for having arbitrary numbers of threads that are calling this remove method, and arbitrary number of threads that are calling the add method. Okay? And remember, the one thing we don't want to depend on is what the scheduler is doing. The scheduler should be able to run threads in any order and the code should be correct. Okay? So the reason this is a while and not an if is, all that this notify has done is it has woken up this thread which had gone to sleep. Okay? Just because it's woken up doesn't mean it's going to run. When you wake up, you go into the ready queue. And you wait for your turn. Okay, so now let's assume that there are two threads, both are calling. The first thread has been woken up and now it's put back into the ready queue, but some other thread comes along and it calls remove. Okay, So the data item that was produced by the producer will get consumed immediately. Right? Then the thread that was woken up by that notify will run, and at that point the queue is empty again. Okay, exactly what was mentioned here. So it's better to go back and check, now that I have been woken up and I am actually running, did something happen between the time I woke up and I am started executing in the CPU? Did another thread come and scoop me and take the data item that was produced, and now the queue has become empty again? Okay. So for correctness reason, you should always put a wait when you use a condition variable and not an if, because if you write an if, you are depending on the scheduler to run the thread that was woken up by that notify first, okay, because something else can happen. This is concurrency, so you can't depend on how things execute. Okay, is that clear? Okay. And another way this can happen is if you call notify all here. First of all, what does notify all? If many threads are asleep, okay, let's say three threads, all of them called remove, they all saw that the queue was empty, they all went off to sleep. When a producer produces this data item, it could have called notify all instead of notify. Then all those threads are woken up. Okay? They all now have to compete. The first one that gets to run is the one that is going to consume that data item. Okay? But you can wake up all the threads if you want. Okay? Because the code, you could write a code where this put not one but three data items. So why not just notify all and wake them all up and let the first three go? Okay? So there is an additional abstraction that says notify all, or also called broadcast in the previous slide. Okay, so this lets all the threads that were asleep wake up, they contend for the CPU, they run in a certain order, and then some of them get to do work, others go back to sleep because the queue becomes empty again. Okay? So now it's your job as the programmer to decide, do you want to wake only one thread or more than one? If you want to wake more than one thread, based on what you are doing in your code, you can call notify all. Typically, you would not do it. You would just use this type of code. Only call notify and wake one thread up. Okay? But the meta point here are two things. We are getting the same functionality as a semaphore. The code, as you can see, has become much simpler. It's very easy to understand. Synchronized, lock. You basically put a lock on this method. Okay. Wait and notify is just like basically going to sleep and waking up. Okay. So this is just a sleep. It's a special kind of a sleep that also gives up the lock before going to sleep. And this is awake. Wake someone up. Okay. That's all these two things are doing. So now it's very easy to write this code. So you basically say, is there something to do? If not, I'm going to go to sleep. And here you basically did produce some work. So you are waking up another thread saying go do that work. Okay, so this will also order in the same way whatever we did with semaphores. Okay, you can order code just by doing the same thing. Yes.
So this makes perfect sense when you have only one method where it needs to wait and one method where it doesn't. But if we wanted to check, like if in the add method we wanted to check to make sure that the queue wasn't full before we added, and then wait if it was full, how do you handle having two separate wait queues?
Yes, so good point. So this is not the full-blown producer-consumer. So I will have only 2 minutes. So this never checked if the queue is full. So if this is a bounded buffer here of size n, here we have not checked. Well, if the queue is full, then you should have actually put that add method to sleep. Right, and then when some remove method runs, it should have woken that up. Okay? The way you would do it is you would have another condition variable. This is not the producer consumer. This is a simple implementation of a queue. If you had a real producers and consumer implementation, you would have two condition variables. Okay? One that puts the consumer to sleep when the queue is empty. The other one that puts the producer to sleep when the queue is full. So you would have while queue is full, wait. So you say some condition variable dot wait, and here you say while queue is empty, some other condition variable dot wait. So you declare two condition variables, just as in the semaphore implementation we had essentially two. Here we had two semaphores. One was putting the producers to sleep, the other one was putting the consumer. So you would have to have two condition variables to do that. So that is why that's not the full implementation of producers and consumers. That's just a simple implementation of queues. Okay, Okay, which if you implement as a linked list, there is no bound on it. So that's the way it is implemented. Okay. Any questions on this? We will stop here. There are some more slides which I'll cover next time. For those of you who came in late, okay, there's a midterm. So you get an extra couple of days before others who did not come to class figure this out. So, and there is a lab and a homework that are also due much before this. Okay, so keep that in mind.